Welcome to the P3 Pilates Progressions Program, brought to you by Personalized Pilates. If you would like more information about the whole P3 program, please visit www.personalizedpilates.com. I'm Katrina Foe, your host for tonight. I'm a second-generation Pilates master teacher trainer, and I'm here to answer all your Pilates and anatomy questions so that you can take your Pilates teaching to the next level.
Hello, and I'm so excited. Sorry for the little glitches. We were working with our new intros and I had a couple of glitches there. So hopefully we'll get those worked out, but isn't our lovely intro music fabulous? My friend Sabrina wrote that just for us, and I'm super excited about it. So we've had a little break, and I'm excited to be back. We've got lots of questions in queue today, so if I don't get to your question, please just wait. We'll get to it next week. And if you have questions that have not been sent in to me, please go ahead and email them to me, and we will get to them as soon as we can. So we have some interesting themes tonight that we're going to be delving into, particularly knees and shoulders. So we're going to jump right in to that. And again, if you have questions, please email them to me ahead of time so we can get them answered. If you want to call in live, we are going to be recording the show, pre-recording it sometimes, but most of the time that would be fine, and you can call in at 347-838-9945, and I will get you in real quick. So, first off, I have this interesting question. Hi, Katrina. I heard a cue the other day for a client to put pressure in their big toe to activate the VMO, and she put in parentheses, vastus medialis, ? Why is the VMO so important? What does it signify when a client's big toes are up in the air when they're doing, in particular, say, footwork on the reformer? The questions keep on coming. I love this question. It's a great one. I'm going to go ahead and start at the beginning and get to all the different nuances of it. So vastus medialis, the O stands for obliquus, which most of the time we don't talk about and is kind of dropped off when we see it on more current today's anatomical charts. However, we still say VMO as like slang when we abbreviate it. I have no idea why, and it's very confusing. And that drove me nuts for a long time when I first started learning the muscles and anatomy and everything. I was like, why is there an O there? So we say VMO, but when we talk about the whole name, it's vastus medialis. Vastus medialis is one of the four quads, so the muscles on the top of the thigh. You've got vastus medialis, vastus lateralis, vastus intermedius, and rectus femoris. And the one we're talking about today is medialis, which is on the midline side, the inner thigh side of the quad. It runs the entire length of the femur and attaches, just like the other quad muscles do, onto the quadriceps tendon. And his major job, just like the other quads, are to extend the knee. So extending the knee is super important. Think of like kicking a ball or something where the knee goes from bent to straight. He does not cross the hip joint. Okay, the only quad, just for review, that crosses the hip joint is the rectus femoris. So rectus femoris has dual roles. He not only extends the knee, he also flexes the hip. And I just point that out because a lot of times that can be a confusing sticking point, because when we say quads, we talk about hip flexors are the quads and all this stuff, and it's really not quite clear for most people that only one of the quads does hip flexion, okay? And the primary job of the quads is knee extension. All of them, that's their focus. So that's where we should, you know, put our attention. So why does the vastus medialis matter? I also wanted to mention on the topic of the obliquus part, there is kind of this discussion or hypothesis, theory, whatever, that there's different aspects of the vastus medialis, that there's a vastus medialis longus, where it's more up and down fibers, and then there's the vastus medialis obliquus, which are more oblique or horizontal-oriented group of fibers. So right now, there's not a lot of, like, one way or the other, but that's kind of where the O is coming from. I thought that was kind of interesting. I came upon that a while ago and thought it was interesting. Anyway, there's no implications for your teaching, though. Most Pilates instructors aren't going to be discussing the difference between the two. Okay, so vastus medialis, why does it matter? Okay, it's most important thing, although it does do extension of the knee, we've got three other muscles that are doing that, is that it really helps contribute to the correct tracking of the patella, the kneecap. It controls the kneecap from the inside of the leg, so it kind of counterbalances the outside of the leg, the vastus lateralis, and some other things we're going to talk about in a second. And it's the one, along with the other quads, that draw the kneecap upwards. So, you know, when you straighten your leg and that kneecap kind of pulls up doing it, because if you remember from anatomy, the quadriceps tendon, where all four of those muscles feed into, envelop the kneecap. I always think that's so fun. The kneecap actually just is kind of what we call a floating bone, and he floats inside that tendon, and then it goes down and attaches to that tibial tuberosity down below the knee. So it really has a lot to do with the tracking of the kneecap, and that's the key thing to keep in mind. And then, of course, when your leg is straight, the vastus medialis is going to help lock that knee into place, so kind of put in that little end point. So for the vastus medialis, this is really important, like I mentioned, because it's got that medial inner side control of the kneecap. And in a healthy person, somebody that's pain-free, the fibers, the vastus medialis, are active throughout the whole range of motion. But if people have some kind of issues going on, whether it's patellofemoral knee pain or chondromalacia, patella, the muscles are going to contract inconsistently, and they get tired really easy, or basically what I call they're lazy. I like to give my muscles personality, as you probably know by now. And so this muscle in particular is notoriously lazy. He goes out to lunch, he doesn't show up to work, and he does as little work as possible. So what I have found in terms of teaching is that it's very important to get him turned on at the beginning. That way he'll, okay, I'll work, you know, and he'll stay on the whole session. If you don't do that, a lot of times he never shows up and never does anything. And especially with somebody that's got issues, so to speak, and we'll just be vague there in purpose, it encompasses a whole bunch of different things. It just doesn't work. Now, you can see this muscle very clearly. It is like a kind of a teardrop-shaped lump, if it's well-developed, right above the kneecap. This is not like the big, bulky center of your thigh thing. This is right above your kneecap, but it's on the inside. And especially a lot of women, like, this is so underdeveloped. You can't see this. And if you've got, like, some adipose tissue, which is a nice way of saying fat on your thighs, which a lot of us ladies tend to carry, just, you know, saying, you'll see it even less. The people that I see it the clearest on are male ballet dancers. Now, I'm sure there are other male athletes and stuff that have beautiful vastus medialis, but that's just what I've noticed, and probably just because I've been more working with dancers to notice that. And they just have beautiful vastus medialises, because the vastus medialis is so important in ballet and dance and such. Okay, so first off, I just want to say that this is a huge problem. It's a common center of weakness for people because it will not become fully strengthened unless the leg is regularly extended fully. Okay, so think about that in terms of fitness and the gym and what we hear all the time. And this is one of several reasons that I get so crazy when people say, oh, don't lock your knees. Oh, don't straighten your knees. Just keep them a little bent and keep them soft. And they say this kind of stuff. And you'll hear it actually in the Pilates world as well, where people get so freaked out about hyperextending the knee that they go to the other extreme and they never straighten the leg. Well, the leg needs to straighten. It's part of our natural range of motion. And you should, in theory, when you, just the regular gait pattern, you should go through a fully extended straight leg every time you take a step. When the leg is in that back phase, it should be completely straight. So in my mind, that is a very important reason why we should practice a straight leg. Now, the other reason that I think is very important in the Pilates world is that there are a lot of exercises, and this is one of the reasons I give my clients, is that there's tons of fabulous advanced exercises that I just won't let people do because it's dangerous if they can't and won't straighten their leg fully. So whether that's a psychological, I've been told never to straighten my leg fully, or a physiological, I can't because I've got problems like with my knee, it does make it a little more dangerous that they need to be able to hold it in a fixed, lengthened position. Now, I am not saying, hear me well, that people should hyperextend their knees. Absolutely not. And we've talked about that in other shows. And if you guys have questions about that, I'd be happy to discuss it again. But I want to try to stay on task and talk about the vastus medialis. So again, this is a common problem because we don't fully straighten the legs nowadays, especially in the fitness realm. And I think it's a huge problem. This is an opinion. There's no research on this because the, quote, cardio activities that we do that people are obsessed with doing and they feel like they are obligated and they're bad people if they don't do, tighten the opposing muscles, things like the vastus lateralis and especially that IT band, which, again, is a tendon, not a muscle, but the tensor fascia lata and all those are very tight on the outside of the leg because of the nature of the way our activities are. So things like running, walking, hiking, stairmasters, bicycling, all those things that people do for their heart and for cardio wreak havoc on their hips and knees. And the place that I see this the most and that is, again, hips and knees, but it's their vastus medialis is usually doing little to nothing. They're doing almost everything with their rectus femoris. So their quads are working. It's just like this very hip flexory dominant thing. Their IT bands are hard as rocks. You put them on the foam roller and they think you put a knife in them. They think some kind of knife pokes out of the foam roller when they lay down on it or something. I've had people accuse me of that. It's terribly funny, but not at all. But you'll see this pattern commonly, especially in people that tend to do a lot of cardio activity. So what do we do about this? Vastus medialis. You'll hear a lot of people talk about isolating the vastus medialis and really doing specific work just on that. Well, you actually can't do that. It's not possible. It works as a group. What they're really trying to say in poor language is that you want to work that knee extension and make sure the vastus medialis turns on, in addition to everybody else. Everybody else seems to bear their share of the work, but vastus medialis, like I said, is a very lazy muscle, and he will say, oh, you're doing it? Okay, bye. I'm gone. And so again, my philosophy is to make sure it's turned on at the beginning of the workout, and usually what I've seen is that it stays on then. And quite often, you have to do that every time they work out and eventually get stronger, and it will start firing more normally and turn on and off appropriately. Okay, so how do you do this? You can do some more PT-like things where you sit up and you have your legs straight out in front of you and you can put like a towel or a foam roller under the knee that you're trying to work on that VMO to make it kind of bend. And then you can just, give yourself some manual tactile feedback and put your fingers on where the VMO should be, whether you do it as the patient, meaning make the patient do it to themselves, or you do it as the practitioner, the teacher. Either way, you'll be able to see it for most people. And then just have them fully straighten the leg. So you're just doing that little last few degrees of the extension, which, again, is the area that the vastus medialis really needs to work. So you should feel that bulge up and contract under your fingers. And again, you want to be on the medial side of the knee, right above the kneecap in the fleshy area. So the foot should lift off of the table or whatever they're sitting on into the midair above the towel or foam roller that you've got it on. So ideally, you should feel a strong contraction. A lot of times, you won't. And so having that tactile feedback can be good for people that are, their vastus medialis is really out to lunge to find it. And, you know, they can obviously see it. They have that visual connection as well as the tactile connection, as well as, you know, auditorily you telling them that's it or no, that's not it. So you got lots of different feedback loops to work with. In the Pilates setting, you can do that and stop and everything if they're having a real problem, but you can do some other things that are a little bit more interesting and just kind of parts of our work. So this is my favorite, and quite honestly, I don't know that I can fully explain why this works so well, but it does. And I'll give you my theories on it, but there is no real aspect of the vastus medialis that does internal or external rotation, but I have found that if you do the second position footwork with internal rotation, it is fantastic for getting that VMO turned on. And if you want to, like, kick its butt, there's your gold right there. And I find that if you get it really worked so the person can feel it kind of getting that a little burn, it's really helpful for the rest of the workout because then they can find it easier, if that makes any sense. I mean, you're not trying to kill it like when most people are talking about exhaustion to where it's, like, quaking and all that kind of stuff, but just to make sure that they can feel it, if that makes sense, the distinction there. So when I do the internal rotation, second position, I have them put their heels on the bar, so we're not doing any weird ankle stuff, and I have their feet flexed, and my mentor, Julian Littleford, was always a real big stickler on pulling your pinky toes back to your knees, he would say, and what that does is it makes sure that your alignment is correct, because when your knees are coming together in that position, when the carriage is in, your knees should be touching, the balls of your feet, you want them in alignment so that your knees are over your toe. And if you stand at the foot bar, you can see this, but a lot of instructors will have it so that the balls of the feet are still parallel to the foot bar. And the shin bone is not perpendicular to the foot bar, so you need it so that the ball of the foot is perpendicular to the shin bone, not the foot bar. Okay, so rewind the recording if that doesn't make sense and say it again a couple times slowly and look at some feet. And then usually the variation I like to do is I have them keep their knees together, touching, squeezed together, and I'll have them go out as far as they can. Now, they will not be able to straighten their legs the whole way, and I validate this, and I'll say some joke about that because that would not be possible or right if they could, but they're going to go as far as they can, keeping their knees together, and that's going to really give them some feedback of squeezing that, and then go in as far as they can without, of course, banging the carriage, and go out and in, again, only as far as they can keep the knees together, and they're getting really good tactile feedback of the vastus medialis touching each other, which we're going to play with that idea in a second. They're also going to be getting a really focused area of that knee extension with, again, like footwork, it should be fairly heavy spring resistance and stuff. Not death-defying, but, you know, a good 3 solid springs or so would be appropriate. Some other things that you could do would be bridging or just some parallel footwork. And in both of those type things, again, you're working on a little knee extension with that, and you'll have to think about that for bridging. Your knee does extend as your butt goes up. But it's not that end range that I was talking about. But what you can do is if you put a small ball, and the size of the ball that you have is going to be proportionate to how far apart their feet are. So if you have like a triad ball or something with maybe, I don't know, like a 10-inch diameter or something, it's going to be a lot farther apart feet than if you have a small ball, like a little Franklin ball or something that's only a couple inches diameter. Anyways, you definitely want to have this above the knee. You don't want to ever put balls at the joints because that's just going to cause friction. The point of the ball is to give them that tactile feedback where the muscle is that you want to turn on, in this case the vastus medialis, to encourage it, and you can kind of feel it better, if you will. So you're not, the ball's not doing anything magical. Once they've gotten that vastus medialis connection, they can find it themselves. They really shouldn't need the ball. But so this is a tool to get them to find it, okay? So always when you're teaching, have that in your mind so that you are giving appropriate cues. Some other exercises would be, I love the Russian squats, you know that. And again, you could do that parallel. A lot of times things turned out can start to help find that vastus medialis. Again, I think the internal rotation really helps because you get that tactile feedback. It's not the internal rotation has anything to do with the movement of the vastus medialis. Doing some external rotation, especially if you're doing something like isometric quadricep contraction or a leg lift, can really kind of help find it. And I think that's because of its relationship to gravity. So those are really both popular exercises in the PT land, but we can do them on the Pilates equipment. I like to layer these for people with knee issues onto existing exercises because they're not very interesting by themselves. So an isometric quadricep contraction, that just sounds fancy. It just means straighten your leg and hold it. So you're using the muscles, particularly the vastus medialis, to hold it. And the beautiful thing about this for somebody with pain in their knee is that it's not going to grind the knee and annoy the joint. If it's already annoyed, it's just going to work on that muscle. So you can layer it on to, say, like mermaid on the chair, where you just have your legs straight out in front of you instead of having them hang down. You could do any of the side kneeling arm series on the reformer, and obviously not be kneeling, just be sitting and have your legs straight out in front of you. You could do stuff, you know, seated arm work on the tower and do the same thing. Cadillac. If you have a raised mat like we do at our studio for the towers, it works because you've got like, I don't know, 4 or 5 inches that you know, to keep your feet off the ground. It's enough. If you're doing it with just a regular mat on the floor, that probably wouldn't work super well. But anyways, those are just some thoughts. The pliés on the chair, the lunges on the chair, the one leg press, the standing leg press rather on the chair, the standing leg series on the tower, all of those would be awesome for working on this. So you especially want to look for that end range of straightening the leg, that extension. And so like standing leg series in the tower, you're not really doing anything with your knee, but that end range, most people when they do the standing leg series, they tend to want to bend their knees a little. And you really want to, I hate the word lock, but fix the knee in a straight position because you're not locking it out into hyperextension. You're just finding your end straight position and holding it. And that's what the vastus medialis is supposed to be doing. So if you don't, you're going to get some twisting going on in your knee, and that is particularly not good. So again, vastus medialis could be something to play with on those. Some of those exercises are quite difficult. And so it depends on the person's level as to, you know, what they can do, but you can work that anywhere is my point, anything knee-wise. So another great thing to do would be, in my opinion, to release the outside of the hips. So especially doing some foam roller work on the IT band would be fabulous. We did a whole thing on talking about the foam roller, so you could review back on that if you're not sure what I'm talking about. And I think it was in Reformer 2 that we go over that. But there's a lot of good stuff with that. And especially if somebody's having really bad knee problems, you might want to encourage them maybe to try a different cardio activity, unless they're just like a diehard runner, and that would make them cry if you said that, just because it really could help. Okay, so that was a long answer to why is the VMO so important. And then I threw in there like how to work it, because to me there's no point in talking about this if we don't talk about how to help it, right? So the other question was, what does it signify when a client's big toes are up in the air when they're doing a particular footwork on the reformer? I have no idea. I'll be really honest with you. Footwork on the reformer, most of the positions, with the exception of the prehensile, or what's called the toes wrapped, your toes would be in the air. So I think I'm just not understanding that question, or maybe I just need a little more clarification. So I'm guessing that has to do with something you've heard from another instructor about the big toe. In terms of the cue for the client to put pressure on their big toe to activate the vastus medialis, I am not a big fan of that cue. I'm guessing this would be from a standing position, and I think the idea is that they're trying to get the client to put weight evenly on the whole foot, and maybe they're rolling out to try to get them more even, and putting more pressure on the inside edge, which would be the big toe, and the vastus medialis to try to get it to turn on. I would not guess. I have not actually tried that. I wouldn't think that would be super effective, and it kind of might have the effect of encouraging the client to then roll in. Again, you would need to check this and see how it worked for the particular client, and I'll be the first one to say that there are no bad cues. There are cues that I thought were terrible that I've seen work for clients just like magic. So everybody reacts to cues differently. And I think that this is one of those ones that if they were really rolling out, you could maybe do it to help them get to stand evenly on their foot, and it might do that. I just want you to understand what you're trying to do and why it would work there. So just trying to get the whole inside midline working by putting the weight evenly from the inside to the outside, it could be very effective. Okay, so hopefully that answered your question. And if it didn't, if there's aspects that are still confusing, or you want to clarify that big toe in the air on the reformer, or if more questions have arisen, please send me an email. Okay, so I have another question that is related to, let me see if I can find it. Here we go. Okay. This is not the same question, but it's somewhat related about knees, so I'm going to go ahead and answer this one next because it's kind of connected. She wrote, "Hi, Katrina. I've been working with a new client in the studio who is a dancer and does Zumba and ballet regularly. She complains of weak and painful knees, especially when working in a side-to-side motion as in tennis. Please explain a little more detail about the knee and how it relates to the hips and the lower body. I suspect the knee pain could be due to weak hips, weak abductors, and weak adductors. I have only worked with her twice, but I have already noticed she struggles with balance as seen in standing leg pumps, and pelvic stability is lacking in feet and straps. Thoughts?" Okay, I have lots of thoughts. First, I'm really surprised that a ballerina would have problems with her knees if it wasn't from a traumatic injury. Most ballerinas have very strong knees because of the work that they do. So I'm going to guess, and again, I'm going out on a limb, that probably either she dabbles in it and isn't, like, diehard, or she's had some kind of an injury. Okay? With all the grand plies they do, that is an incredibly strengthening exercise. That would be shocking to me that she would have that. Now, again, it says she does Zumba, so maybe she does a lot of the cardio stuff that I mentioned before, too. I don't know. I would go through and check. I think you're onto something in terms of noticing her struggle and balance, and she's got weak and painful knees. And I think you're 100% right on in terms of focusing on her weak hips and leg muscles, because that's exactly what you want to look for. So, I'm guessing, but this is what I would look for when you work with her next. And again, you don't have to do anything special. Just, just working within the lesson plan, you can just look and see, are her abductors or her adductors strong? You can even throw a little foam roller on her IT band at the end and see how that goes. But I'm going to guess it's probably weak adductors, so inner thighs. And again, that's just a guess because most of the time, that's pretty weak. And again, most of the time it's that inner thigh, adductors, and that vastus medialis that we just talked about. So I would focus on that and, again, check it and see if that is her weak spot in the muscle imbalance like we've talked about before. All the knee exercises that we previously mentioned are going to be awesome for them. I would just go slow with her If she's weak, these exercises are going to be hard, and if she has pain, what you want to do is just reduce the range of motion. So for things like Russian squats are a great one that you can easily modify to exactly what the client needs. So have them do it exactly like normal. I would definitely have them do feet together, all the way together, so that they can get the feedback of squeezing those vastus medialis together. Most people that have weak knees, when they do Russian squats, if you watch their knees carefully, they do this side-to-side jiggly thing instead of keeping their knees exactly over their feet the whole time. And so doing it with feet together just makes it way easier for them to get that tactile feedback, and not, they'll notice it because they'll be banging together, and that doesn't feel good. And you'll see that in a lot of the videos, and a lot of people ask me why I do that, and that's exactly why I do it, and it just makes your life so much easier, especially if you're teaching a class, to have that. You could alternatively, like I mentioned, put a small ball, and you would want to have the feet open proportionate to how the diameter of the ball. Okay, so again, that would give it that feedback as well. But then in terms of the knee, just go down as far as they can. And the beautiful thing about that exercise is that they may get to where their hips are level with their knees. They may get to their butt touching the ground, but the great thing is that you can totally customize it, and it could be a completely different range one day to the next based on if their knees are irritated or not, which is awesome in my opinion. And you are just giving them 100% responsibility to take ownership of determining how far they can go. And it's not a contest. It's what is appropriate. You don't want to irritate things. Pain is your friend. Pain is your guide to what your body needs to do and what your body doesn't. And if you don't honor that, then, of course, it won't have as good a progress, and they will have pain. But the other thing with it is that one of the most shearing movements and strainful movements on the knee is this motion where if your foot is stable and grounded and your knee is, and particularly your thigh bone part of your knee, is going forward past your toes, the angle of shearing force where your knee goes past your toes puts a huge amount of stress on your cruciate ligaments, so your ACL and your PCL, ACL in particular, and you hear a lot of talk about that, and that's what is happening when people commonly injure their ACL is they like do something like in basketball where they plant their foot suddenly and their leg is still going forward, and that can put an incredible amount of stress on their leg. Again, I'm going to guess, I don't do Zumba a lot, but that is a motion that would be part of Zumba and things, and it can be part of ballet. It's not a commonly thing, but the beautiful thing, like I was mentioning, of the Russian squats is that it doesn't have that. The knee stays firmly over the ankle the entire time, and the thigh bone, you can get the full range of motion because it's going behind the leg in this motion. So you get the full range of the knee without having that shearing effect, which is genius and gorgeous and fabulous. So a lot of people that have knee issues, this is one that they can do a full range of motion sooner than a lot of other things. So, for example, the plié series on the front of the chair is much harder on the knees because you've got the knee going past the toe. Is it an evil exercise, like some people would say, that is contraindicated no one should do? Absolutely not. It's a fabulous exercise. But you have to have already strong legs to do it. So it's just a matter of being appropriate about your leveling of your client and choosing wisely, not just everybody gets the same thing. Hopefully that makes sense. Sorry, got a little tickle in my throat. Okay, so in terms of pelvic stability, I think it's awesome you noticed that. Again, I have really, really never seen a serious ballerina that has problems with pelvic stability. And if she does, this would be profound for helping her dancing. So I would make sure, first off, that she really understands the concept of hip differentiation. So what that means is being able to hold your pelvis still and move at the hip joint, so the thigh bone moving independently, okay, or moving, holding the thigh bone still and moving the pelvis independently. And that's exactly what you're doing in the exercise that you gave an example of. So you hit it right on the head. So when you have feet in straps, any of those little leg variations, your pelvis should be absolutely still, in neutral, So your pubic bone and your ASIS are parallel to the mat, the carriage, and the movement should 100% be at the hip in terms of the thigh bone going up and down. Now, depending on the different variations you're choosing, there may also be some movement at the knees or whatever, but the movement at the hip should not be coming from at the back, meaning the space, one of my favorite cues is the space that's under your back when you start should stay consistent the whole time. And I'll go so far as to get pretty graphic and be like, I just put your newborn's arm under there. Don't squish it, you know, and give them some motivation. They don't want to squish their baby's arm or, you know, there's a cockroach under there. Don't squish it or, you know, whatever motivates them to really keep that consistent the whole time. If they don't get that, make sure that you can explain that to them and they understand it. Also, you might want to go back to the movement principle knee fold. And in the P3 program, we go deeper into knee folds and just review that with her and how to do that without just using rectus femoris. So we talk about the hip popping when you put your fingers in that hip crease and not, and that's, again, that's where the rectus femoris lies, and not having that pop up when you bring the knee up. Okay, so if you see them doing the knee folds and their foot comes up into tabletop, again, tabletop's not evil, but that's not what we're doing in this exercise. You want to keep your foot so it's down by your butt the whole time and try to do that lifting of the thigh bone without having the knee extension, which is the foot coming up into tabletop. And that will blow people's brains. They will just be utterly mystified as that is not possible, they will say. I can't tell you how many workshops I've done where people argue with me, that's not possible. I'm like, okay, let me show you. And they put their finger down and they, oh, well, how did you do that? And they just look at me. I'm like, that took me about a year to figure out how to do because I was a hip flexor queen. And it took its toll on my back. But what you're doing is you're teaching your psoas, which is also a hip flexor and is an incredibly important muscle, to do some of that work that, again, cardio activities in daily life a lot of times just the rectus femoris learns to take over. And so our job as Pilates instructors is to retrain neuromuscularly the body to how to have good habits and to be well-balanced. And so in this case, the well-balanced body is going to need the psoas to do its job as much as the rectus femoris. And this is really common in ballerinas. They'll tend to be rectus femoris dominant. They'll never get really good because you can't lift your leg up into a beautiful extension from your rectus femoris. It won't really go past 90. And probably she's, if this is an issue, she's capping out there, and she's probably got a huge quad, like that cheerleader thigh look, because that's what she's trying to recruit to do it. And if you can help her figure this out and use her psoas, her thighs will slim down. Ooh, that pique anybody's interest? I think when I figured this out, it took like 3 inches off my thighs. Okay, and I'm not talking about fat. I'm talking about the bulgy, poofy-out muscle that like makes jeans look bad and stuff. It just shaved it off because I all of a sudden had a new pattern, and I could use my psoas to lift my leg up. My extension got way better, and, you know, voila, all this other stuff, because the psoas does hip extension primarily higher than that 90 degrees and stuff. That's your go-to for that. So, again, it's just using the muscles the way they're supposed to work and appropriately, not just a lot of times people get an injury or something or they get in a habit and the other muscles are like, oh, okay, well, you're the dominant one. I'll just let you do it all. And they just kind of shut down and, you know, they don't do anything. You mentioned balance. You might, this is random, on the standing leg pumps, want to make her balance a little easier by moving the mat for a time being, because that squishy mat in front of the chair, if you're leaving it there, will actually make her balance quite difficult. Again, not a bad thing, and definitely add it back later when she gets good at it, but if she's really, really having a hard time, and this goes for elderly clients or, you know, anybody with bad balance, move that mat just for that, to really help them. You can also give them a gondola pole, but again, if you're working on balance, that might make it too easy, so you have to know what you're trying to do with that. Okay, so I'm going to jump to another question. Okay. This question is from a new P3 person, so welcome. And she wrote, "Hi, Katrina. I have a client who has an abdominal hernia from a laparoscopic hysterectomy." Say that 5 times fast. Okay, she wrote, "She says that they went in above the navel. My question is, can this be healed with transverse abdominal work, or is surgery the only solution? If they do surgery, what kind of surgery would this likely be? I think TA work is worth a try, but I don't want to offer false hope. Thanks for your help." Well, I love your heart to not want to offer false hope, and I think that you're right on track with your thinking. Here's the thing. If you do research, the research is all going to say, you know, go for surgery and stuff. Well, let me back up. Let me discuss what this is for our audience. So a hernia is when a bit of your body that should be inside, like, you know, your intestines or bowels, actually pokes out through a weak spot in your abdominal wall. So your abdominal layers are not the strong thing that they should be. This is a weak spot. When I say weak spot, I mean the abs. So much so that your guts are sticking out. And if that doesn't gross you out, it should. It's not a good thing. And people talk about hernias like it happens to you. This is not something that just, in this case, yeah, it does. But a lot of this stuff, people get hernias all the time. And it's there's precursors. They should have seen this coming, the writing on the wall, because, you know, their abs were not strong and they were not taking care of themselves. Now, there can be things, like in this case, that happened to them. But again, that's kind of more the not the norm. So a hernia after a hysterectomy is relatively uncommon as a side effect for the abdominal hysterectomy. It's also sometimes called an incisional hernia. And it occurs because the abdominal cut that they make weakens the muscle in the surrounding area. So this creates kind of a tender and painful bulge in the muscles surrounding the area. And again, things can start to poke through where that cut was. Now, I'm going to guess that probably you're not getting the huge bulge that you can have with some hernias where it looks like there's a little alien popping out when you do some ab work or something. Probably it's very small. And that's a good thing, because if they're going in laparoscopically, it should be small. Again, this totally depends on the individual, though. It can be somewhat painful, and it depends on how painful it is, whether it's the doctor pressuring them to get it fixed or the person is really uncomfortable with it or it looks aesthetically unpleasing, et cetera. Just little stats, it's more likely to occur in people that are overweight or who have a history of repeated abdominal surgery. Other causes of incisional hernia after hysterectomies can be lifting too many heavy things during the recovery period. Okay, I think that's really key because the abdominal scar is weak then when it's still healing, so that you want to let it heal and, you know, fully heal before you start lifting things. And that thing could be like a toddler, you know, if it's you know, something that they did postpartum or something. So therefore, a lot of these occur 3 to 6 months after surgery takes place. And again, it's another good reason why people need to avoid lifting after they have surgery, you know, not too soon. You don't want to jump into that kind of stuff. Okay, so usually there's two options for treatment, and every doctor, you know, has their own little thing. So one of the things they'll recommend is to wear a support garment, so like supportive undies or belly bands or something where it's like a corset or kind of a girdle, usually, you know, really strong kind of lycra spandex sucking you in kind of thing, so that it applies constant pressure to the hernia. So the idea here is that it's going to pull the belly together so that the muscles can have time to knit back and heal back together so the hole can close up. If the belly's just all hanging out, not to be too graphic, and just, you know, flaccid and loose and whatever, then there's going to be a lot of pressure pushing out on the belly, especially depending on where they have the hernia, especially if it's in, like, the lower half under the navel. There'll be a lot more pressure pushing the guts out through that hole versus if it's pulled together, It's kind of like having a butterfly bandage over a cut to keep it closed together while it heals. I don't know if that analogy works for you. The second option is surgery, and that involves the hernia being replaced back to its correct position, so closed back up in the abdominal cavity before the muscle is either repaired with stitches if it's small or with a mesh graft if it's larger. So the stitches obviously dissolve and everything and are much preferable. The mesh graft, I have heard people that have had the graft for like diastasis and different things that have complained that they just never feel the same and that it's kind of painful if they do anything like extension, especially like extreme extension, because it's like pulling on it. Just a little thought, side note. So this is kind of like a diastasis, which we, I believe, mentioned in the pregnancy protocols very thoroughly. But the diastasis is a separation of fascia versus this is a separation of muscle. So there's a very distinct difference, but the treatment is very similar to diastasis. So what the doctor's recommending is the same, and what we're going to recommend is the same. I'm going to opt with you and agree with you that I would definitely every time say try TA first. Yet, you know, I think the supportive garment would be fine. I don't think it's going to hurt. I think the most important thing, though, is that is not an alternative to getting your TA working. Okay, that's just a, in the meantime, while you're not very good at this and it's not very strong and you can't sustain the contraction and hold it in, that could be a Band-Aid crutch, if you will, in the meantime. So what I would do, and again, this is her choice, is to really work on her TA, make sure she knows how to activate it, make sure she understands that she should be trying in daily life to turn it on, not necessarily death grip, but get it turned on during the day as often as she can possibly think about it, and to practice it. The more she does it during the day, and again, she doesn't have to spend like a half an hour five times a day or something like that, just while you're doing the dishes, check out your TA. You know, while you're on the phone, check out your TA. While you're in line at the grocery store, check out your TA. You know, the more often she does it, the quicker this is going to heal up. Now, the supportive garments could just be the, again, the crutch to kind of help her so that it doesn't annoy itself before this becomes autopilot. So the idea is that her transverse gets stronger because she's doing it all the time, right? And then it can eventually become something that is strong and natural. So she doesn't have to think about it. And this is what usually happens with clients, in my experience, the motivated ones at least. I'll help them find their TA. I'll empower them to try as much on their own. And you know, they make some progress in their sessions and everything. And then usually after a couple months, and again, it depends on individuals are varying, but they'll come in one day and they'll go, Katrina, guess what? I was walking, you know, my dog, and all of a sudden I realized my abs were pulled in, and they were just already kind of doing it. And I was so excited because, it's like you said, it was kind of going on autopilot. And again, I'm not talking about a death clench. I'm just talking about, like, if you fully let your abs hang out, and then you just kind of pull it in a little. That's what I'm talking about, that, like, you know, if you're kind of zipping up your tight jeans. Not jeans that don't fit, but just some, snug jeans. Okay, so those are my thoughts, and she could always do this and try this and work for several months, and then do surgery later. I mean, surgery will always be there if she wants to do it. To my knowledge, and I could be wrong, it happens. I don't think there's like a window where she needs to do the surgery in a certain amount of time, or bad things are going to happen and things like that. So it's just a matter of the doctor's telling her to do it, and you know. She can put that off, in my opinion. Anyways, so that would be my thought, and you're free to share that with her. Again, I am not a doctor. I have not seen her move, but those are some general thoughts. I am a very strong believer that the body can heal itself if we give it the tools it needs. So if we teach it proper movement patterns that it has forgotten because of trauma or injury or whatever, and give it the nutrients and such that it needs, it will heal itself. I think a lot of times we are too quick to try to intervene, to speed things up, or to not have to do the work. Because you know what? This is work. It is. You know, you have to think about it and work on it and try to find it. A lot of people, they're just lazy. Now, I'm going to go out on a limb and say this lady is probably not lazy if she's coming to you in the first place and if she's interested in trying to do something. And I know you aren't lazy because you're a Pilates instructor and you love to work on this stuff. But a lot of people out there, they just want the pill that will fix it or the surgery that will fix it. And I just remind people there's always implications for surgeries. I don't care what the surgery is, there's always side effects, whether it's the medication, whether it's, you know, the side effects of, you know, having, you know, less range of motion or other problems arise from the surgery. Like, this is a really great example, you know. This whole thing is because of a surgery. So I'm not saying surgeries aren't necessary in certain cases. I'm just saying that you just really want to consider and weigh out all your options. And I would recommend just trying some of these alternative weirdo approaches, like working your transverse abdominis first. And this is, you know, related but not necessarily to your specific case. But a lot of times, you know, it's really important to remember that when we are talking to clients about doctors' recommendations and stuff, we want to tread lightly because, again, we aren't doctors. But just keep in mind that the doctors are not trained in movement. And this sounds so obvious, but they're trained in surgery and drugs. And they really don't even know what else is out there in terms of movement alternatives that and what it can do to help. Okay, I have a lot of clients that are doctors, and they'll be the first ones to tell you they don't know this stuff. They're not trained in it. And I think that it's very arrogant of anybody, whether it's a doctor or a Pilates instructor, to think that they know what is best when you don't know all the options thoroughly, kind of thing. So they don't know what they don't know, and this is not their specialty. This is our specialty, and it is a possibility to heal that. So getting that abdominal wall strengthened is something that you can work on with her and that you are well informed about. So if you have more questions about that, please let me know. And I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up, although we have quite a few questions that I didn't get to tonight. I will get them to them next week. So we had some questions about shoulders and all sorts of fun things that we are going to get to next week. So again, send in your questions and let me know what you would like to talk about. You know what? Actually, I lied. I'm going to finish with one more part of somebody's question. She actually wrote two questions here, and this one I think I can answer real quick. She wrote, on to a nutrition question. I've heard tomatoes and potatoes are nightshade vegetables, which means they cause inflammation in the body. Is that right? Should we be eliminating these from our diet? I don't eat many potatoes, but I really like tomatoes, and I'd hate to think they're causing me harm. Maybe the good outweighs the bad? Question mark. I look forward to the show. This is a really great question. So what is a nightshade? Nightshades are bell peppers, so those are the sweet ones, eggplants, goji berries, also known as wolf berries, hot peppers, so chili peppers, jalapenos, habaneros, chili-based spices, red pepper, cayenne, paprika, pimentos, potatoes, not sweet potatoes or yams, though, tobacco, tomatillos, and tomatoes. So there's quite a few of them in there, and I just want to really highlight that there are a lot of spices that contain peppers, and a lot of packaged foods have some kind of peppers in them. So there's a lot of discussion about the nightshades, and there is a lot of evidence that they are highly irritating and inflammatory. Now, there's what's called glycoalkaloids, which are a natural pesticide that the plant produces to keep the bugs away. And in a healthy, normal body, that has no problem. It just goes right through you, no big deal. If you have any kind of a leaky gut problem and stuff, this can actually cause problems and cause a strong inflammation response and such. There's also some talk about that this can be a potential cause for what's called leaky gut syndrome due to its ability to poke holes in the lining of the intestines and such. There's also some discussion, and this is some animal research that I thought was interesting. It may not convey to humans, but they're not sure on that, that there's an extremely potent form of vitamin D in the vegetables that actually prevents proper calcium metabolism, which causes the body to deposit calcium in the soft tissues where you don't want it instead of in the bones where you want it. And so that can be a problem and an irritant in joints for people. So there's a whole bunch of different things that possibly are going on there that can be a problem. This is not a problem for everybody, okay? I just want to highlight that. But if you have joint pain, especially arthritis, I have seen a lot of people with arthritis that find tremendous benefit from avoiding nightshades. Okay, so it's really simple. All you have to do is take them out of your diet completely, even the spices, and see how it goes. And usually, you give it a week, 2-3 weeks, you'll notice a huge difference if they're something that is a problem for you. A couple of things that I'll mention in addition that help them to not be quite so bad is that if you peel your potatoes, most of those alkaloids are found in the skin, and so you can have your potato and have a lot lower effect possibly. There's also a lot of discussion about that unripe nightshades are higher in alkaloids. And this is really interesting because green peppers are basically just the colorful ones, not ripe. So you want to avoid those. And same thing with green tomatoes. They're just not ripe tomatoes. So avoid those like the plague. Most tomatoes in the store, and I don't know about peppers too, but tomatoes are not actually ripened naturally where they would start to decrease in the alkaloids. They are artificially ripened by the stores, and so they're much higher in the alkaloids than if you buy, you know, or I'm sorry, if you grow your own or something. And I'm guessing that the, quote, vine-ripened ones are better, but I'm not 100% sure on that. Just know that if store-bought tomatoes really bother you, you might have a friend that grows some tomatoes in a garden that might not bother you. That might be a good check to see if it bothers you by trying to grow your own. Also, if you cook the nightshade vegetables whenever you eat them, this will help reduce the alkaloid content further. I've seen some debating about that, but it's worth it. And quite frankly, who wants to eat a potato that's not cooked? I sure don't. But those are just some ideas and thoughts. So I know when I looked some of this stuff up, I was surprised that goji berries were part of this. You know, it's interesting. I knew most of the others in the spices. The spices are the big ones. So if you find that you have a nightshade problem, I'll just say intolerance, whatever you want to call it, you really need to be careful about prepared foods and what spices people put in there. So the cayenne, paprika, red pepper, any chili kind of spice, you got to stay way away from because it'll just set you off like crazy. Anyways, those are some thoughts about nightshades, and it's kind of off the topic, but yet, let's face it, we have so many clients that have arthritis, so many, that, you know, if you can just put a little bug in your ear and, you know, you might want to try avoiding nightshades and see if that helps at all. I mean, you can make a huge difference in their life, and you're not telling them what to eat or not to eat. You're just giving them some information about things that might help, because I feel very strongly that the work that we are doing with Pilates is so beneficial to people, but it is not the whole piece of pie. It's part of the puzzle. I'm mixing my analogies here. And it's not the whole thing. There is such profound effects of food on the body that most people are completely unaware of, and a lot of them are completely not wanting to change, not wanting to do anything about, which is fine. But, you know, especially all these inflammation issues, the autoimmune diseases and stuff, they really have a lot to do with food. And so that's why I do bring some of this into our discussion, because I want to be able to help my clients as much as possible, and I know you do too. So when we come across this information, even though it's, quote, outside of our scope of practice, to write meal plans and stuff for them, we can pass along interesting information that they might want to check out themselves and decide how to implement. So there's a lot of really great elimination diets and allergy diets and stuff, and there's a lot of information about these nightshades in particular. And what I've seen with my clients is that it can really, really help with things like arthritis. All right, so now I'm officially done for tonight. I hope you had a great time, and I look forward to hearing from you and your questions. So, good night, and have a great one. Mm-hmm.